Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half hour featuring unique personalities whose ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers Newark. And now, Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Michelle Bratcher Goodwin is a Chancellor's Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. Professor Goodwin researches some of the most controversial issues in society: human trafficking, reproductive rights, the politics of organ transplants, and the international black market for body parts. Professor Goodwin, how did you become involved in investigating the black market for body parts? You don't look like that kind of person.
I know. I don't look like that kind of person. But first, let me thank you for having me on this show. You have such impressive guests here. So it's I'm greatly honored to be on the show. But really, the genesis of this goes back to my childhood and what I thought of as just simply ghost stories or folklore from my great-grandfather.
In Wisconsin?
No, actually, he was in Mississippi and is my maternal great-grandfather. And he had a large homestead there. And during the summer, great-grandkids would gather. And at night, we'd hear these stories. I'd spent about 1 week of my summer there. And he'd tell these stories about bodies being experimented on and slave bodies buried after experimentation underground and things like that. And they just seem like ghost stories. But when I was in law school...
Wait a minute. What year was that?
That was in the early 1970s, the ghost stories. And then I was in law school in the early 90s, 1992. And a story broke about cadavers being found in the underground of a southern medical school, and about 400 cadavers, and they were believed to have been African slaves. And the light bell, and the light bell, too, went off. And I thought there was something to this. And as I began to research about organ transplantation, tissue transplantation, early experimentation in the United States, what I learned is that we had a significant and robust industry, if you will, in grave robbing in the United States. And African Americans had to post guards outside of their cemeteries in the 1700s, 1800s, because bodies would be pillaged and pillaged for parts, because American medical schools at that time were really schools of anatomy. And the way in which these schools would recruit the finest students is that they would promise each one a cadaver to experiment on at medical school. And they had to get these bodies from somewhere. And if you notice, Harvard's medical school is not on its campus. It was located, it is still located, Pauper's Row. Deans of medical schools authorized grave robbing. The University of Michigan, Johns Hopkins, so many of them, the most prestigious ones, were ones that easily got their hands on cadavers. And much of this was appropriated through graves, and a lot of it African-Americans.
Your great-grandfather, did he give you any kind of ideas on how to keep your family tree intact after he passed?
You know, not so much. I'd say that early inspiration really was a throwback to those stories and folklore. But I tell you that probably the most significant inspiration in terms of family for me growing up was his daughter, my maternal grandmother. She was really quite a remarkable woman who passed away while I was in my sophomore year of college. But I was able to spend my first few years of life living with her while my parents lived in Montreal. I lived with my grandparents, and it was really just so incredibly rewarding for me. It truly shaped who I am today.
Were they angry?
My parents, were they angry? Yeah, they
were. Your great-grandfather and your grandmother, were they angry about what was going on?
You know, here's the fascinating thing. There were very different people, my great-grandfather and my grandmother, his daughter. She was a remarkable woman because both filtered through Mississippi. And, you know, the films that we know that tell us so much about Mississippi, Mississippi Burning, the documentaries about voting rights and whatnot, that was the reality that she lived in. I mean, she picked cotton before school. She picked cotton after school. She lived in the bowels of deep segregation. She lived at a time where people were literally lynched and strung up in trees, where the U.S. failed to live up to its constitution in Mississippi. No voting, no equality in housing, no equality in schooling. I mean, you go down the list of all those things that we now can take for granted and still have some challenges within our country. She lived through that. And yet, what was amazing is that she never instilled in me any sense of hatred, disdain for others. She had a very noble sense about right and wrong and also about justice, but she was able to carry that out without a sense of hatred of others. And that was truly profound because she was incredibly mindful about discrimination. She was incredibly mindful about the status of women. As I grew up in the household with my grandmother, I was introduced to many aunts only to find out later that these women were not biologically related, but she was in a way facilitating her own underground railroad. She was providing a migration stop for women who were coming north for work, who were escaping domestic violence, and she gave them free shelter and she protected their dignity in that she never told me their stories. They were just simply Aunt Bernice, Aunt Anne, and so forth.
But the U.S. stories now.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they
you're sharing
are.
Them automatically. I'm watching you, and you're not even thinking. You have no notes.
No.
All you're doing is just telling me this, almost this narrative is, and that you've been brought
because
up with
because
it
was
that
so incredibly rich. And I have to say that I live with those same principles and values, and that family is truly relative. It's important to respect and honor the dignity in others. And that's what I saw within my grandmother. I mean, she was a part of a generation that is truly lost and underappreciated in the United States. When you think about the fact that it was these black women who were these church-going nurses and teachers and domestics who made our Constitution alive, who demanded a right to vote, who demanded equality for their kids in schools. Because think about it. I mean, what we say is we honor our founding fathers, but who made the Constitution real? And real in such a way that now for so many other groups in the United States, the Constitution is real. But it was born on the backs of these women who said, you can arrest us, you can drag us away, you can hit us over the head, but we believe in an equality for all, and that includes us, our kids, et cetera. It really is quite profound, and they are the forgotten.
They're the ones who taught you. What are you teaching?
Absolutely.
You have a stepson. You have a daughter.
Yes, I do. Well, the same things. You know, what my grandmother truly emphasized sets of values, right? And these were not values. They're values that now follow a political pattern, right? That is to say that these days, those who talk about accountability talk about it from the right. But I grew up in a household with my grandmother where accountability, integrity were incredibly important. Your dignity and how you carried yourself was incredibly important, and a sense of perseverance. And, you know, what I've come to appreciate as well is a profound sense of empathy. And that is truly what I saw amongst the adults in my life, my grandparents, that is to say.
I spend a weekend reading something called Black Markets, the Supply and Demand of Body Parts.
Yes.
That wasn't easy.
No. wasn't easy to write either.
Yeah, I'll bet it wasn't. Well, but it was well done.
I was
astonished by it. I got to page 171 and I was sweating.
That's a great compliment.
And I'm reading about all these things and the ethics in this stuff. The fact that so many hospitals, so many grave robbers running around our country, running all over the place.
Today, I have
a feel it's still going on today.
Well,
you
it
must
is.
Be, I've looked at your resume and your CV in academic language, and it seems like it's nothing stopped.
No, nothing has stopped. And in fact, the early genesis of that work really does extend back to law school. And these are still battles that we're dealing with today. So the book itself is about tissue theft, organ theft worldwide, trafficking, but it's also the narratives of pain in the United States. We have high rates of diabetes, hypertension, high blood pressure. All these things shut down our bodies. And so the real question ends up being, well, how do we get access to these medical treatments that can save lives, including organs? And this is where we go down the rabbit hole. Today, we have more than 100,000 people waiting for kidneys on an official transplant list. But many people know that they will never get that kidney at all. And so some people go to China, India, Brazil. They go on black markets. And yet we have another 500,000 Americans that are on dialysis, and they're dying, and many of them don't even know that they would qualify for an organ transplant.
And then we have the ethics, which we'll talk about in a second.
Yes.
But meanwhile, you're listening to Conversations with Alan Wolper on WBGO-FM 88.3 and WBGO.org. Our guest is Professor Michelle Bratcher Goodwin, a Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, who researches, if you haven't figured it out by now, things like civil rights, civil liberties, human trafficking, and international black markets for body parts where we're at right now. But
yes,
there's also a waiting list. I mean, you wrote about
huge
an incredible situation where the governor of Pennsylvania jumped from, I don't know, 5,000 to one
the
list.
No, this is, Governor Casey. And I think that story helps to embody much of the controversy behind this. So
Tell us the story.
Yeah, so Governor Casey was diagnosed by his doctors to need two organs. And by that diagnosis, he was able to skip thousands of people on wait list. And he was flown via helicopter to a hospital where he received the organs of a young man who had been beaten to a pulp. The other part of the story, the young man who had been beaten to a pulp, was a poor black guy who lived in the community that actually had been the first on the governor's stop when he was campaigning. And the governor had promised jobs and a better way of life for all those people. But it didn't pan out for this poor African-American young man. And he was beaten so senselessly, it was a mistaken identity among some members of a gang, his mother couldn't even get an ambulance to the house. Police didn't help. She had to drag her son's body into the car and drive him off to the hospital. And that's where we get to this tale of two cities, the governor helicoptering in, and this poor black guy ends up being the donor to the governor. He dies. The mother donates his organs. But it sets up a narrative about transplantation.
That was 1993,
Yes, exactly.
Is that going on today? People jumping to the front of the line?
Well, yes and no. That system changed. The regulations in Pennsylvania changed so that would not be allowed. But we still see incredibly concerning and disconcerting disparities. African Americans are more likely to need kidneys, but they have the highest rate of death on our transplant list. They wait longer than any other group on our list, and they get kicked off at a higher frequency than any other group on our transplant wait list for kidneys. So we need to address this issue, but unfortunately, we're not honest about medicine in the United States. We're not transparent about these kinds of things at all. And if we were able to have more honest, transparent conversations, we could get to the bottom of some of this. I think one significant problem has been the federal law in this domain. It's the National Organ Transplant Act. And that law says that there can be no valuable consideration in exchange for an organ. This means there can't be a cup of coffee, a cup of orange juice. It also means that if somebody wants to donate you a kidney, that person can't receive a reward of his mortgage payment or her mortgage payment, can't get their rent paid for, can't get their electric bill paid for, can't get, you know, the gas, the kids' lunch money, any of that. Now, when you begin to think about that, that makes no sense. It means it's very difficult for poor people in the working class to donate.
What is the difference between a grave robber and someone who goes from number 200 to number one? It seems like it's close. You're stealing body parts, or you're not allowing someone to get a body part so you could live.
What an amazing analogy. Well, you know, we do have a legal system that has rules associated with it on our organ transplant list. But as you've read in the book, there have been many breaches in protocol. There have been ways for people to maximize getting ahead on transplant wait lists. One way to do that is to simply be wealthy and to register at many different sites across the country. If you're poor and you live in New York, you're going to register with the Organ Procurement Organization in New York and hope that an organ becomes available. But if you're wealthy, well, you can hopscotch all across the country and register at lists all across the country so that you maximize your opportunity of getting an organ sooner than someone else.
Black market, the supply and demand of body parts, was written back in 2006 approximately.
Yes.
Same. Nothing's changed then.
No.
9 years later.
No. And in fact, it's only gotten worse because the wait list is now thicker, more people die, and now more people seek opportunities elsewhere around the world to pillage parts from the poorest people around the world. I mean, in China, there are prisoners that have been executed in order to provide organs for Americans. I mean, we know this. Our Congress has known this. There have been several congressional hearings about this in the United States. We know that people go to India. We know that people go to Pakistan. This is not a question in the dark. This is one that we're very aware of, at least in terms of the government and policy. Yet we've not had the courage in Congress to reshape our legislative protocols in this area.
People don't know about this, the fact that they could get body parts, or they have to learn about transplants and all this kind of things that the very, very wealthy know automatically because they have the kind of people who advise them.
Absolutely.
I don't think Donald Trump will have any problems.
No, of course, Donald Trump would have no problem. And in fact, part of what inspired the book is that there was someone that I knew who was chair of a very large school district. He was the first African-American to be chair of that district. His name was Jerry Devine, an amazing person who had brought so many progressive-minded policies to this particular school district. And when Jerry was diagnosed with end-stage renal disease, I asked Jerry if he had been placed on a transplant wait list. And he looked at me and he said, "A transplant wait list?" Jerry was an African-American man who had spent years as a principal and then had spent years working for not-for-profit organizations, volunteering. And he had never been told. His doctors, Jerry died without receiving a transplant. Jerry died without ever being on a transplant wait list. He was totally stunned when I told him that he should have been on a transplant wait list.
An educated man.
An educated man who relied on his doctors to tell him. But one thing that many people don't know is that we have a lot of rationing that goes on in this domain. And what that means is that before you get placed on a transplant wait list, your doctors must see you as worthy. And so there are people who sometimes are never told about an organ transplant if they've
what
not been
worthy?
Educated. Well, this is a very good question. In the 1960s, there was an organization that was called euphemistically the God Squad. And this group was to decide who would have access to dialysis. And the God Squad decided, and it was comprised of a housewife, a lawyer, a priest, a business guy, that if you'd been divorced, you're not worthy. If you were not college educated, you were not worthy. If you spent any time in prison, you were not worthy. Fast forward, what does worthy mean today? Well, it depends upon the doctor, but we know that sometimes even a kid's school grades will determine whether or not he gets on a list. There was a kid a couple years ago in Georgia who was denied access to a heart transplant wait list because his doctors, in a letter written to his mother, told them that the kid had bad grades and had had trouble at school.
God Squad, the God Squad sounds like some religious organization.
Well, yes. And this kid was an African-American 16-year-old African-American kid. And there was uproar. I wrote about it and others, and they backtracked and they placed the kid on a transplant wait list. But this is what happens to folks. And for people who lack political clout, lack economic clout or social clout, they have difficulty bringing attention to these denials. And so, yes, they happen when people are divorced. They happen when people are poor. They happen if people have had a drug addiction. They happen when people have been incarcerated. And much of this goes on without Congress doing anything about it.
And you went around the country telling everybody about it.
I have, yes. And I'm here now telling folks about it.
The person you're listening to tell us about it is Michelle Bratcher Goodwin, a Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, who researches just about everything, human trafficking and the international black market for body parts and reproductive issues as well.
Yes.
There's hardly anything you don't cover. Civil liberties,
civil rights. So what has fascinated me is law's intersection with the body. You know, when you think about it, for law professors and lawyers and law firms, you know, they've spent time thinking about property interest in real property in buildings, in cars, in things that we see as tangible in these domains. But when I was in law school and after law school, I truly became concerned about how does law interact with the human body?
There
was
far
less. I went to Boston College Law School and then did a postdoc at Yale and then did a postgraduate law degree at the University of Wisconsin. But what fascinated me was how little had been written about the body itself and how law interacts with the human body. And when you begin to think about what are the kinds of rules and norms and identities that we associate with the human body, who owns your body? Who has a right to tell you something about your body? And you think about this. Marlies Munoz, a woman who was diagnosed as brain dead, was forced in the state of Texas to be kept intubated on life support because she was gestating a fetus. She was dead for all practical purposes. But the state of Texas told her husband and her parents, even though she would not want to be kept on life support, and even though you disagree with this, the state now has taken control of her body for all practical purposes because she has a fetus inside of her. Does the state own someone's body? And you think about that, the ways in which the state can make certain claims on your body that you might not want the state to make those kinds of claims.
But each state has its own law or laws that affect people, and you can go from state to state the same way you can collect your transplants.
That's absolutely right. And when you begin to think about that within the context of dying, when you begin to think about that within the context of birth and birthing or pregnancy, and for example, the state of Wisconsin has a law that it can institutionalize a woman against her will to protect its interest in her fetus.
And you know all about Wisconsin because you went to the University of Wisconsin.
Yes,
exactly.
Well, yes, that's right. I did graduate from there. But I find this fascinating. I mean, there's a woman who was—
Is Wisconsin different?
Well, Wisconsin's one of a few states that actually permit for this civil incarceration. I mean, they've even kept a woman in solitary confinement without providing her a lawyer, but providing one for her fetus. You know, one has to question
Wait
this.
A minute. You're going pretty fast now. You just said that the fetus is being represented by an attorney?
Even when women are not. Yes. Yes. And, you know, it's absolutely fascinating. And I find it problematic across the country. It's another conversation that is in urgent need of address.
It always is addressed during presidential campaigns.
Well, and you know what? It's happening now, but it needs to happen at even a more transparent level. Here's an example that I think many people would appreciate. There are women who are being threatened with arrest and incarceration for refusing C-sections. Again, it raises questions about who owns the body. In cases where women say, well, no, I'd like to have a vaginal delivery.
Where?
the state of Florida, in New York, in New Jersey, in Pennsylvania, across the country, this has happened. There's a woman named Lisa Epstein in Florida who was threatened by her doctor. She told her doctors it was Wednesday. I'd like to come in on a Friday. I'd like to wait longer to see if I can have a vaginal delivery. And the doctor said, you are leaving me with no other choice but to have law enforcement come and drag you in here. Really? No other choice? Seriously? And the World Health Organization has already said it, that in the United States, we do 3 times the amount of healthy C-sections, putting women's lives at risk.
What happened to her?
Well, Lisa, a white woman of some resources, contacted her lawyer, who contacted the National Advocates for Pregnant Women, and they backpedaled because she had resources and she knew what to do. But imagine if you're poor and you are threatened with law enforcement dragging you to the hospital so that a doctor can saw open your belly because he has another appointment. He has some place to get to.
That's a doctor who knows about the Hippocratic Oath as opposed to another one.
Well, here's the thing. And it is not to say that there are times when a C-section may be medically appropriate, but we know that we're using this excessively in the United States. And red flags have been raised by international organizations saying that, look, this is just unhealthy in the United States. Why in the world is this going on?
I don't understand how a doctor can do that. You have to explain that.
Well, this is also something that's become very complicated, and that is doctors serving as a kind of quasi-law enforcement for the state, which is a very problematic role for doctors to be in my opinion.
A doctor is almost like carrying a weapon?
Well, like, almost, right? Almost. Well, when you think about cutting open a woman's belly against her will because she wants a vaginal delivery, but you've either got an appointment you've got to get to, or you've got the business department saying this is how we want, you know, these deliveries to run. Business department of the hospital. There's a case very recently, in fact, with the business department of a hospital in Florida that, yes, threatened a woman, you got to get in here and get this C-section and not a vaginal delivery because they can time it. It's quick. You don't have to worry about a woman being in labor for 10 or 15 or 20 hours like I was, but instead it's zip, zip, and you sew her up and it's done. But it doesn't mean that it's healthy for her, and it puts women in a very problematic position, and I think it changes the nature of the physician-patient relationship. But even more, Alan, what I would emphasize are these calls to law enforcement where doctors have taken to providing private medical information of their women's patients and have provided it to law enforcement, breaking down
local cops.
Yes, breaking down the fiduciary relationship and revealing information that women would otherwise understand as confidential.
I would think that the doctor would be arrested for something like
well,
that.
Well, you would think that, but that is not what has been happening. And instead, what we've seen in Alabama alone in the last couple of years, more than 400 arrests of pregnant women based on information that has been disclosed by their medical providers to law enforcement. And what this does is that it sends a chilling effect to women who otherwise you want to go in and receive prenatal care, if they know going in might risk them being arrested and dragged away in front of their kids, who would go to then seek care?
Professor Michelle Bratcher Goodwin, a Chancellor's Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. Thanks for sharing your almost unbelievable stories with us.
Thank you for having me.
Joanna Wolper is senior producer of our program, and Doug Doyle is executive producer, and Conrad Seguin is our engineer. Carmen Ballantyne was a special consultant on the program. If you want to meet some of the other guests whose lives and ideas, like Michelle Bratcher Goodwin, are on the cutting edge, just Google Conversations with Alan Wolper. Until we talk again, I'm Alan Wolper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Wolper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.